about the military, that there are always people who will tend to be very critical of wherever they are, you know, and who find some sort of solace, I guess, in complaining about everything and finding other people who share their unhappiness. But there were a lot of Americans who were extremely interested in Iran, too. I mean, you know, there was a course given at Tehran University on Iranian cultural history and so on. And many, many Americans attended that. A lot of people went on trips in Iran. A lot of people went to various cultural events that were sponsored by the, say, the Iran-American Society. There were trips organized to various historical sites, and people, you know, thousands of people went to Persepolis and Isfahan and really tried to learn a lot about the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it's wrong to, you know, see a pattern of ethnocentric behavior among everyone. There are always going to be groups who take that attitude, but there were also a lot of people very fascinated with Iranian society and what made the country the way it was. And I was always impressed when I ran across people who had made many trips and read books about the country. And so it's a mixed picture. Also, by that time, you know, even the stereotype of the rich Westerner having servants in his house, that was breaking down entirely, because the Iranians felt that they no longer wanted to be servants. You know, only very wealthy people could afford a cook by the time we came back to Iran in the 70s. Before, we had a man and a woman in our house. The man did the cooking, and the woman did the washing and cleaning. By the time we came back, we could only afford a maid who came in occasionally to clean, and we had a succession of those. Many of them really just not willing to work. You know, they would just go into whatever room you were and make a lot of groaning and moaning as they cleaned, you know, to show how much effort they were putting out, but really were just doing a sloppy job. And it was really very hard to find any kind of a person. In fact, some of the Iranians and Westerners were importing Pakistanis and others to run their household. So I think it was unusual for Americans to have servants in Iran when I came back. A lot of Americans did their own cooking, and maybe they just had someone come in and do some of the cleaning or washing. But basically, a lot of American wives followed a schedule that was not unlike what they do here. You know, cooking and cleaning, caring for the family, taking children to athletic events and plays and maybe ballet lessons or whatever. I mean, there were all kinds of things like that going on. So it really wasn't, you can't really equate it with India, you know, where you might have routinely five or six servants doing everything in the house. It wasn't that way in Iran when we came back. It was very unusual to find families with even one full-time servant.
Now, in his book, James Bell has a very interesting analysis of figures from the world of American corporate law and finance industry and high-level politics, but the figures who constituted the bedrock of support. The bedrock of U.S. support for the Shah.
Mm-hmm.
And the shorthand term for this is Pahlavism. Now, from your own experience of the embassy in this period, the 70s, or even earlier, how much of a sense did you get of who the influential private individuals and institutions were who sought or who favored a close relationship politically and economically with the Shah?
Well, I think the way he's phrased it is quite correct. We would see frequent visitors from among that group of people that he cites in the book. These were people who came frequently to the country. The Iranian government was extremely active in bringing people to the country for tours. I mean, they routinely brought groups of Americans in and gave them tours around Iran, and of course they had, during this period, they had periodic festivals, fine arts festival in Shiraz, that they organized an Aspen Institute seminars, and you know, did a lot of activity of this type, and they brought not only American but other foreign visitors in for these affairs, and there were a lot of papers prepared, and you know, theme conferences held. Iran was a very popular destination for various organizations to have a conference, you know, archaeology conference or a sociology group or a historians meeting or whatever. I mean, they really catered to this kind of activity, and they brought a lot of people in. So they were very active on the PR side, and certainly they calculated that most of the people they brought in this way would go back to their home countries as firm supporters of of Pahlavism, if we use that term.
Well, in terms of your own observations of the embassy, were any individuals, names of any people stand prominently in your mind of people who were influential in terms of affecting American policy?
Well, it's hard to single out individuals. I mean, of course, Lilienthal, from early days in the development of resources, he was a well-known figure there. He mentions the Rockefellers, and I mean, there's so many names in there, it's hard to cite them all from memory, but McCloy, all these people were occasional visitors, and certainly were known to be among the group that were cultivated by the Pahlavi regime. As I mentioned earlier, that Mr. Macy was over there.
Is this Carl Macy?
No.
No, this is someone, I think it's somebody else.
What was his first name? Anyway, he had been the chairman of the Civil Service Commission, and he was under a contract with the Iranian government to help develop their civil service and, you know, increase professionalism and training. And so a lot of people like that came in and under contract to the government, and they became, in a sense, people publicizing the accomplishments of the Iranian government, because they were figures known in their fields, and they were working for the Iranian government.
Now, another issue that he raises, and that other scholars have raised this issue as well, I think, is the question of bureaucratic rivalry between the various official American organizations in Iran, between the embassy and the CIA, between the embassy and the MAG, between the embassy and the USIA organization, and so forth. And he suggested these rivalries between the various official organizations tended to hinder the ability of American officials to do their jobs well. And that also Iranians also sometimes exploited these bureaucratic rivalries for their own purposes. Let's look at this issue a little bit closely, I guess. And how would you characterize the relationship between the embassy and the Amish MAG, the military mission? Was there a lot of rivalry involved, or?
I wouldn't put it so much in terms of rivalry as I would put it in the terms of different objectives. You take an Iranian military person, he would have no contact whatsoever with the embassy, but he would have a great deal of contact with an American military advisor who was attached to his particular unit or his service. So there was a reluctance to get in touch with the embassy, because it was known to be forbidden territory. In fact, it was to the point where we could not invite Iranian military people to any embassy function without going through a special procedure of sending invitations to the Iranian Supreme Commander's staff, and they would then decide who among that list would be allowed to come. not every Iranian military officer, and I'm talking about officers now, of course, we would never go below that, but even officers of fairly high rank were not all able to attend American functions. They would generally pick and choose among those themselves and say, well, you can have this many people. We'll send the invitations, the rest they just destroy. So the Iranian military is very sensitive about contacts with the embassy, but they had constant contact with the American advisors. So then, obviously, the next step is that American embassy people are talking to American military advisors saying, you know, we need to know more about the Iranian military. Please tell us about some of the people you're working with, where they were trained, what they're like, what political ambitions they have, what political awareness, just all kinds of, sort of a profile of an Iranian military officer. And our advisors would say, we can't do that because we're not here to spy on these people, we're here to work with them.
They wouldn't share information at all.
They wouldn't share information at all. And we constantly argued this out. We would have meetings, country team meetings, other meetings where we'd say, look, the Iranian military is an important force in this government. No matter what you think of it, it's a power base for the Shah. We need to know what the military is like, because if the Shah suddenly dies tomorrow, probably some group of military officers would take over and run the country. And if history is any guide from other countries, it's not going to be a general who's going to take over. It's probably some lieutenant colonel or major general as a front, but it's probably going to be some lower-ranking officer who's going to be calling the shots behind the scenes, or maybe a group of them. And we really need to know something about these guys. We're not going to do anything with it other than just, look at it and analyze it, but we need to know. And they just consistently refused to do that. They said, our job is not to spy on these people and tell you about them. Our job is to work with them in a military context, give them advice, mm-hmm. help them train their troops, help them utilize the equipment they're getting, and that's it. And just you're never able to really get that point across. Occasionally, you would get somebody who would write a perceptive report. I've been here a year and a half, and my main contact has been Mr. So-and-so, and Major So-and-so, and he is, and they tell about the guy. Sometimes this would be done within the military establishment, and we wouldn't even get a copy of it. Other times, if we did get copies of it, if they were feeling cooperative at that particular period, they might share some of these with us. But it was a very hit-or-miss thing. We just could not get across the point that this was a unified activity. I mean, their goal was to train, and our goal was to understand what's going on in the country, and they just couldn't see that we could cooperate. And of course, if we met with Iranian military officers, we could learn something about them just from talking with them. But there were so few who were allowed to come to functions that you never could really get below a certain high level, because they were the only ones who were on the Iranian list of who's allowed to go to these parties. Because they too felt that if we started in meeting some of their people at a cocktail party, we might cultivate them and learn more about them, and they just wanted to sort of keep at arm's length from that.
That's interesting. James Bill also suggests that the CIA tended to keep its information away from the embassy, and this created some problems at times. How true is that from your experience in the 70s?
Well, that's much less true. Yeah. We had quite a cooperative relationship. On a personal basis, we interacted constantly. We knew each other, and we shared information, even if maybe the institutions that we worked for didn't always directly that we shared. We shared on a personal basis. I would say that it was fairly cooperative. There were, of course, times when there were differences of view about certain things, and that you might get one slant from embassy reporting and another slant maybe from agency reporting, but that was, I think, fairly rare. Now, again, oftentimes it's a question of resources. I mean, Jim Bell mentions Ernie Oney as one of the analysts from CIA. Mm-hmm. I've met Ernie many times, and I was always very much impressed with his depth of knowledge about Iran. And we, you know, we've debated back and forth about various things and had good conversations. But the agency was generally able to put so much more money into whatever study they wanted to do than we were that, I mean, they, you know, Ernie Oney and another fellow, what was his name, Chandler or something, in this book, they worked on Iranian affairs over a period of decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
State Department people were always coming and going. I mean, I was unusual because I served there earlier and then came back. But many people just had a two-year tour in Iran and then off and never came back. So, you know, the degree of specialization that mm-hmm. that they had was greater than ours because of the resources. And they could afford to have our, and I mean not only in the field, but our people in INR, who we had usually one guy analyzing Iranian affairs, and he would be there for 2 years and then gone, never come back. So here's Ernie Oney and this other fellow who were over all those years working in Iran. So that, you know, they should have done a better job overall than they did because they had people who concentrated on for a long period of time on Iran.
Hmm. Hmm.
But in an operational sense, at the embassy, I think we had quite a cooperative relationship. And so his characterization there, I think, is a little off base.
What about the relationship between the embassy and the USIA? How would you describe that?
Well, I think that, again, the question of objectives comes in. The main objective of USIA is to publicize and inform people about American life mm-hmm. in all facets of it. And that can be obviously done in so many different ways. And at various times in their history, they've emphasized more one method or another. In earlier days in Iran, it was the film show. They would send mobile teams out into tiny little villages and hook in and set up a screen and send around by word of mouth and by notes. In fact, there would be a film showing that evening, and the villagers would crowd around, and they'd see two or three films, and wasn't this wonderful? American technology is right here in our little village, and you know that was a big deal. By the time I came back there in the 70s, that approach had been pretty much put aside, and we were dealing with both the Iran American Society as an institution with all kinds of visiting Americans who came and gave speeches and talks about various things, and a whole range of publications that were dedicated toward different groups in society. We had one sort of picture book with limited captions and short articles that we put out, Mars High, you know, New Frontiers or New Horizons, something like that, is the translation. Mars is a border, so it's sort of new borders, but further idea was new frontiers or whatever. And that was this very nice publication done up with a lot of pictures and short texts and so on for sort of general distribution. Then we had some more intellectual magazines with long articles, just a few pictures. We had really something for everybody. We had, of course, our daily wireless bulletin that we sent out. We had Farsi texts of any declaration that was made that was felt worthy of further distribution. We'd have that out in Farsi within a day or less. Tremendous activity on publications, and I think there was a a sense that in the end of the release, in my view, there was a feeling that USIA was too concerned about mechanical activities, the mechanistic approach. In fact, you see it in the USIA report. You'd say, we have placed 25,000 column inches of stories in this month's publications, and we have distributed this many thousand of that publication. So, as if, just the fact of sending out all these things had accomplished a goal in itself. And, we told some of our friends in USIA that we would buy a little bag of nuts in the bazaar, and it would be made from pages of an American magazine, and you could read it. Of course, you could also buy nuts in a cone made of some embassy report, some unclassified report that had been thrown out, and they saved these things, and they made a little cone-shaped device to hold peanuts or whatever. But USI publications often showed up in bizarre merchant stores as wrapping paper. Mm-hmm. And we said, how do you have this down as if it's been accomplished, sending it out to people who are going to read it. Maybe they just throw it away and it's used to wrap packages. There was a little bit too much emphasis on that. Mm-hmm. Another project I remember was one to keep track of all our contacts with Iranians. That is, which Iranians get which publications, and do we send this kind of publication to these people, and are there more people we should send it to? We had these lists of people who were getting it, and then we could add to it. We could say, I've got a friend, Mr. So-and-so, who would be just right for this intellectual magazine that you've got. Let's put him on the mailing list. That was good in the sense that you could follow up with a contact and maybe expose them to something that would be very worthwhile reading. So we tried that. But some of it, again, was, the system took up so much time to keep this big project of who gets what and analyzing it and going over the mailing list and finding out who had moved and whether it was going to the right address. Just the mechanistic problems just overwhelmed some of these projects, as good as they might have been in the abstract. So I felt that they tried a lot of things, and some of them were very good and some were a waste of money. And, it was all just pursued hell-bent for leather as if it was equally, all equally important. And I'm sure they felt, as it came across in the book, Jim Bill mentioned some feelings on the part of USIA people that they didn't get enough support from the embassy. Well, as one who's taken part in a number of things that they put on, I agree. It was hard to get embassy officers to come and take part in after work affairs. You got a busy social schedule, all kinds of things you're supposed to go to, and cultural events you want to attend, and you're supposed to be seeing some Iranians at various times and getting together for dinner with them or whatever. You've got a very full schedule, so, to block out another 2 or 3 hours to go and hear a lecture and take part in a discussion afterwards, a lot of people just, passed it up. But I've been to many of these lectures that were put on by USIA. They got some very good speakers to come out, and some of them sparked a real interest on the part of the audience, and lots of good questions. But then some others were just, they just sort of fell on deaf ears, and you get an expert in some field who would give a talk, and there'd be 2 or 3 questions from the audience, and that was the end of it.
Hmm. In the mid-70s, the question of human rights in countries like Iran was becoming an issue of controversy in Congress, in the press, and elsewhere. And what kind of impact did Rushnell and other American criticisms of human rights, criticisms of the Shah have on having the embassy? How was this question handled?
Well, it had a lot of influence because we kept getting not only the generalized articles where people brought up criticism of the Iranian government, which were appearing in more and more publications in the States, but we started getting a flow of very specific requests, people writing letters or contacting the State Department, and they would forward it on to us about, I want to know where Mr. So-and-so is, because I met him at so-and-so conference, and I understand he's been picked up by SAVAK, and a friend of mine told me he's being tortured. I want to know. Please find out. Let me know. And we did. We followed up on all these requests. I mean, we would go into the Ministry of Justice, or we'd, we'd use other contacts and try to find out and get the word back to people. People that came out, excuse me, to look into human rights affairs, we gave extensive help to them. Butler, who came out and looked into human rights, I've met with him, and I've, you know, both before, during, and after his approaches to the Iranian government, sort of debrief him and find out what he learned. And we had very, and, well, I was the officer who was mainly responsible for human rights reporting and contacts in the embassy in this period. So I wrote up analyses of what these various missions accomplished when they were there, and I wrote up detailed studies of how the Iranians carried out their judicial proceedings, and the changes that the Shah gradually implemented to satisfy some of the complaints. He actually did make some changes in his procedures in the government to meet some of the criticisms. Of course, that, I mean, it, somewhere between the extremes of lurid tales of tens of thousands of people being tortured to death, and the Shah's statement that, well, only a few people in prison, they're all terrorists, they don't deserve anything because they're terror. In between these two poles, there's obviously some area of truth there in the middle. Clearly the Shah either directly ordered or tolerated a lot of hideous torture by some very sadistic people in his government. But then you put that against what Khomeini did when he came into power, and the people that were killed with no semblance of a fair trial. I mean, a lot of the trials that were put on in the time when I was there, they weren't fair by our standards, but they were trials. I mean, there were defense counsels, there were juries, there, you know, there were some procedures, and you can attack the procedures, and people did. Jurists would attack the fact that the accused was not given a bill of particulars in advance to prepare his case, or that he wasn't given enough time, or that his defense counsel wasn't well prepared. You know, all kinds of things you could criticize, but there was at least a certain set of procedures. And when he came into power, just tens of thousands of people were just killed with the bare trappings of a trial, just people yelling and screaming as to what they did, and what do you think, killing. So I think it has to be taken into context. There were some liberal magazines in the States who made, you know, very lurid tales of, who wrote lurid tales of torture, which, and I'm sure they were based on fact. I know they were, because there you have people who've written first-person accounts of how they were tortured, and you've read some of those, and there, I've read some of them, and they're cited in Bill's book. But the extent, the number of people who were tortured, I think, was overdone. And there were all kinds of things in between, of people who were just, you know, picked up in sweeps through areas where they had some kind of a problem. They picked up a lot of people just on suspicion, and sometimes they'd be held for months. Just inefficiency. They didn't really know who they had or why they had them, and finally when they realized they had the wrong people, they let them go. But they were, of course, embittered by that time, because they'd been held maybe for months or even, I don't know, maybe even years on charges that were not true, but and then eventually released. But, of course, they were so embittered by that time that they joined against the regime, too. So there were a lot of very sadistic procedures used on Iranians, but the number has been overstressed, and the consistency has been overstressed. There was an awful lot of inconsistency and just pure inefficiency, where they didn't know who they had and why, and they tortured some people when they shouldn't have, and they let other people go that were probably guilty, and there was just a lot of inefficiency in their system. But surely there was enough grounds for complaint. But it is true that the Shah made some changes to accommodate some of the views of these groups who came in and made quite thoughtful studies of the Iranian judicial system and how it worked.
I guess this is more towards the end of your stay, that these developments were occurring in 1976, after 1976.
Right.
Yeah. Was there much of an effort made by higher level officials at the embassy to try to deflect American criticisms of the Shah?
No, because the things we got were generally, as I mentioned, some very specific questions about Mr. X, who hasn't been seen. His family says he's been picked up, and so-and-so wants to know, and please find out. So we'd find out, and we'd send the word back through either directly to the person or through State Department channels. We did a lot of just fact-finding, looking into the situation and trying to tell people back home just what the situation was.
How many, in terms of like delegations that came to visit the country to observe the situation, generally they might have raised human rights issues in passing, whether briefing officials would try to find ways to minimize the criticisms or the criticisms?
I'm sure that depended on what level you're talking about, yes.
Yeah.
I know I talked to people very frankly when they when I was the briefing officer. I'd tell them very frankly what kind of things were going on. But I'm sure that Miklos, when he briefed people, World Affairs Council group breezes in and here's the deputy chief of mission to talk to you. I'm sure he wouldn't even bring it up in a long briefing session. And if somebody asked me, probably, minimize it, saying, well, yes, there are some people who engaged in terrorism and so on. And but he'd probably say something like, well, Iran does it, but it's no different from any other country in this area, that it's, you can't apply the same standards as we have to this part of the world. And, there's some truth to that, too. I mean, Turkish jails are no prisons. No picnics either. They're really tough places, as you saw in that movie that was made about an American in prison in Turkey, Midnight Express.
Now, in 1975, I guess a national intelligence estimate was prepared, directed by George Harris, I guess, with an INR that year. And the report discussed at some length the opposition to the Shah, among other issues. Did you see the draft report when it was circulated? Do you recall seeing this report? Burrell talks about it a little bit in his book.
I'm pretty sure I would have seen it, because generally papers that were written back in the department were sent out to us for comment, and I think we probably read that and made our comments on it.
He suggested it caused quite a lot of controversy in Washington. I guess in the embassy there was some criticism in the embassy. Because the report dealt pretty frankly with the opposition to the Shah, and do you recall anything about that controversy, or the
frankly, I don't know that particular report. Yeah.
Okay. How long did you stay in Iran in your second stay?
Just 2 years.
Yeah.
1974 to 1976.
And you left when in 1976?
July.
Uh-huh.
That's why this report is probably my last major written report.
Because decision making.
Yeah, it's dated 18th of July. That's just probably days before I left.
Mm-hmm. What was your next assignment at State?
Well, I came back and went to an energy-related job in the Department of Commerce.
Oh.
We had an exchange agreement between State and Commerce. And I was in that for a little over a year. Then I went to the Department of Energy because the office that I was in Commerce was made a part of the new Department of Energy, which, as you recall, gathered together all parts mm-hmm. of the government that were dealing with energy and put them under one head, mm-hmm. under Schlesinger. So I went with that group and finished up my two-year detail with DOE.
Uh-huh.
And then at that point, they offered to send me to Antwerp, Belgium, as Consul General, so I went there for 3 years, 78 to 81. So I was in Belgium when...
During the revolution.
When yeah. the revolution occurred, yeah. But you know, I should say that before I went off to Belgium, I still kept up with some Iranian events because I knew the desk officers working on Iran. I met some people. I met Sullivan before, you know, when he was in on consultation, and I heard several of the presentations, including Bill and Zonas and others that were financed by INR.
Oh, only 78?
Yeah.
I guess before.
Right, when they wanted to get an assessment of where Iran was heading, and they mm-hmm. they brought these people in, and I attended some in summer of 78. Early summer, must have been early summer or spring mm-hmm. of 78 before I went out.
Mm-hmm.
I remember particularly going by the desk and reading a report that talked about various demonstrations that had occurred in widespread parts of Iran, where people had sacked railway stations and attacked mm-hmm. Savak posts and gendarmerie posts and so on. And at the end of this long litany of all these various attacks, the embassy said that it had been unable to establish any pattern that coordinated all of these attacks. So apparently there wasn't any organized activity to direct this. And I said to the people in the desk, I said, that's exactly the wrong conclusion, because the fact is that if all of these separate activities are taking place against the regime and they're not coordinated, that shows that it's really serious, because it shows that it's widespread among the populace, that they're unhappy and even, you know, angry at the government, and that's why they're taking out their frustration on these government offices. But they, you know, the embassy, I thought I sort of missed the point on the whole thing.
This is the embassy's perspective you're talking about.
Yeah, the embassy's perspective uh-huh. in this reporting that I was reading. So I thought they were, you know, misconstruing the importance of these wide-ranging and uncoordinated attacks.
That's very interesting. During the revolution itself, well, as revolution deepened in mid-78 and continued to early 79, were you contacted by anybody at the State Department, or were you in touch with anybody?
Well, I was in Belgium, as I say, of course, I started to learn some of the details of what life was like in Iran after the revolution from some of the Iranians who applied for visas, because they were coming to Europe any way they could, getting out of the country, and then a lot of them were trying to get to the States, so they'd come in and apply for mm-hmm. for an American visa.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And generally, I interviewed them then, you know, in addition to question of the visa.
Yeah,
asked them some general questions about life in Iran, so I learned a lot of details there. Also, I learned something about the revolution and the aftermath from Mogadam, who fled to Paris after he got out of Iran, and
mm-hmm.
and he came to visit me in Antwerp for a couple of days and
mm-hmm.
had long talks, and I reported some of the things that I was hearing from him back to the department. So I was aware through the information copy phenomenon of various things that were happening. Mm-hmm. I was seeing some of the reporting from Iran, and even in my post in Antwerp, there were info copies being sent to Brussels, and I would get a copy of those. So I was keeping up in general terms.
From your perspective in Antwerp, what was your assessment, or what do you think of the way that the Carter administration approached on revolution?
Well, Of course, I was seeing everything after the fact. That is, I wasn't seeing anything that was sort of in a way of a think piece or how should we proceed, what should we do. All I was seeing was the reporting of things as they transpired. I felt that the Carter administration started out on a reasonable footing with the new government, that is, once Khomeini had taken over. This is the import of your question. Once it had taken over, or?
Well, actually, the development up to that point also, the policy towards the Shah and the...
Well, I was appalled by the fulsome praise that was being given to the Shah in toasts and so on by Kissinger and Carter, when Carter visited there and, you know, made these very effusive toasts about this wonderful world leader about whom, and Kissinger was saying, we've come to learn from this experienced world leader, share views with him and learn his insights into the world to help us. I mean, it just, to me, it was just so far overblown that it was ridiculous. I mean, again, as I say, I never was one to say that we should have just in some way gotten rid of the Shah, but by the same token, I think we made a tremendous mistake putting him up on a pedestal and forgetting about his problems. And that, you know, we've got to see this man, warts and all. We have to know what we're dealing with. And we deluded ourselves, and those toasts that I read of Carter and Kissinger various times, just praising the Shah to the sky as if he was a paragon of, you know, international knowledge. And he wasn't. I mean, he made some very clever moves in some ways internationally, but as a leader of his own country, he made a lot of terrible mistakes. And he's the one that suffered for him. And as Bill said, the Shah started lashing out everyone once he left the country. It was everybody's fault. It was the United States' fault. It was the other countries who undermined him. It was the Congress's fault. It was everybody but himself. I mean, he never felt that he'd made any mistakes. There was all these other people who had undermined his authority. He had all those years to do something with this country, and he made a lot of foolish mistakes, and in the end he paid for it. That's my view. And as I say, I think the relations with Iran were totally mishandled in those last days of the Shah's regime, because and I mean by the government in Washington, I think credit must be given to the people at the embassy that they were finally convinced that the Shah was on shaky ground and that we had to make a move to pick up some pieces and start getting to know who Khomeini was and making contact with him. Even the Shah admitted that. But we, you know, Brzezinski had this idea that somehow we could save the Shah if we just gave him a stiff backbone, you know, told him we're behind him, we're behind you 100%, and this was not going to save the situation. There's a lot of debate as to the time frame, September, October, November of 78, whether the Shah could have been saved or not. And I've heard pros and cons. My conviction, and I've talked to some British diplomats who were there at that time who shared this, and it's my impression that if the Shah had cracked down firmly on any signs of dissent as late as October of 78, he could have saved the situation. Now Bill, this is where I part company with Jim Bill, because he feels that the revolution was had so much momentum by that time that no matter what the Shah did, he was already losing by that time, and that he couldn't have done things then. I think that's wrong. I think even with the ferment that was going on at that time, if the Shah had been firm and consistent in applying force, that the Iranians would have grumbled, but everything would have settled down again. I think he could have saved the situation. But when it went beyond that, then you had the 40-day phenomenon, as you know, where, you know, on day X, students are killed,